Yes.
That.
If you could say what you had for breakfast.
I had porridge with flaxseed on it and also yogurt with raspberries and homemade granola because I'm that sad.
Wow. That is the cover of a Waitrose food.
It really is.
Catalogue.
So painfully middle class.
Was it nice?
It was.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
It's the most ingredients we've ever had.
Really?
As a breakfast.
I have two breakfasts. One at 6 and then one at 8.
True Tolkien-esque style.
Is it?
Well, the second breakfast.
Of course, yes. No, yeah,
the
I am
one
a
thing
hobbit,
I know about it.
Frankly. Yeah.
Well, I didn't want to get into personal slurs so early on in the interview. Hello and welcome to Spilling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest this week has had a hugely acclaimed and varied career, but has always maintained storytelling as a consistent thread throughout it all. Starting out as a journalist, she soon entered the world of politics, working in Downing Street alongside Alistair Campbell and Phil Collins, not the drummer, helping craft Tony Blair's speeches and later writing them for such senior figures as Alistair Darling and Tom Watson. She then moved into novel writing, in particular those for children and young adults. Her creations such as Where Do You Go, Birdie Jones, The Queen of Bloody Everything, the Flying Fergus series, which she co-wrote with Olympic gold medal winning cyclist Sir Chris Hoy, and Joe All Alone, have won countless awards and widespread acclaim. Joe All Alone, in fact, as we'll discuss, was adapted for the screen by the BBC and has subsequently won a BAFTA and has just been nominated for an Emmy. In addition to all of this, we spoke about everything from how writing a novel is like writing a speech, how to turn dry subject matter into inspirational narrative, what Roald Dahl was like to meet in person, how having the Prime Minister edit your work changes you forever, and the sheer neurological, chemical-altering power of good rhetoric. So, please welcome my guest for this week. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Joanna Naden. Jo, thank you so much for talking to me today.
You're very welcome.
Now, you've been a journalist, a political speechwriter, of course now an award-winning novelist, and a lecturer in creative writing. In fact, we're speaking at Bar Spa University, where you are a lecturer. So it's fair to say that you're a fan of storytelling.
I am. Story is my life, and I think always has been since I was a small child. I never set out to be a writer. I just wanted to be in a book, and I was always reading, imagining I was whoever it was I was reading about. And I think that's where I write now, because I want to spend huge swathes of time imagining I'm someone else other than me.
So it's a cathartic exercise, if nothing else.
It's cathartic. It's also, it's how I make sense of the world, really. It's therapy. It's when if I at any point once I every time I finish a book, I sort of have that great, now I can not write for a little while, it will be a holiday. And after about 2 days, I'm tetchy and irritable and I can't work out why, and then I realize it's because I'm not writing and I start another book.
So it's an addiction, again. If nothing else.
It is an addiction. Yeah, I don't drink, I don't smoke, but I write all the time.
So what was your gateway drug? What was the first book you fell in love with?
Oh, gosh. I honestly don't remember a time when I wasn't always reading. And it was the Ladybird Book of Dinosaurs was my first obsessive book that got so battered it fell apart. And at one point, I think I'd taken it into school and left it there and was devastated.
Sure.
But it's now retrieved and I own it again. But it was Ladybird was my first books. My mother taught me to read before I could, actually when I was still at nursery school, so that I was made to sit in the Wendy house by myself while other children were taught to read and write. I was ostracized for having actually already managed the task. And then I moved on to Dr. Seuss very, very quickly, and Roald Dahl, funny books basically. I think I always, that was what I was interested in, humor. And then I discovered ponies, and that was that for a long time.
Roald Dahl has come up a lot in previous episodes. Gabe Mollica, who's, I think, episode 4, mentioned Danny, Champion of the World, his favourite book of all time. And I believe you met Roald Dahl when you were a little girl.
I did. I was a member of the Puffin Club, which was a sort of kind of like a math club or a chess club for book geeks. Mm-hmm. And we had a little pamphlet that came out every so often, and you got a badge, a Puffin Club badge. It was Puffin Books ran it. And I went to a convention in London. I must have been about 8 or 9, I think. It was also on the same day I went to a recorder concert. I was that level of geek as a child. And I did, I met Roald Dahl and he signed something, which I no longer own, of course.
That's a pension in an item.
And the sad thing is I don't think I was that excited or impressed by meeting him.
Really?
He was an old man who seemed quite austere, and that wasn't what was exciting about books to me. What it was exciting was the story, and if I'd met Charlie from Chocolate Factory fame, that would have been exciting, but meeting the author meant nothing to me. It's only now as an adult that I realise how lucky I was in retrospect.
Yeah. It does seem to be that there's this the push for authors to be more characterful in person.
We are, certainly for children's authors, you are suddenly finding yourself oddly thrust into the limelight of even if it's only school visits. Because the point of most of us being writers is that we like to spend huge swathes of time by ourselves, locked up in a room. I studied drama at university and immediately knew I'd made a mistake because I don't really like being up on stage in front of people. Or I certainly didn't then. Now I'm much more used to it because I lecture. I have to be able to do that. But I wanted to be the backstage person, and that's why I liked writing. But now we do. We have to go out and meet people and do events. And I do actually oddly enjoy it now because I've sort of managed to create a persona that can do that, whereas the other me, the main me, is the one who would rather just be sitting by themselves with their head in another sort of story, another country, another child's head or another adult's head.
Like Beyonce has to adopt the role of Sasha to go on stage. Do you have a name for your alter ego?
No, I don't, but now I really want to get one. Possibly not Sasha, though, because Sasha was my great aunt's dog as a child, and I know.
Well, I hope Beyonce doesn't hear this.
No, beautiful dog, red setter, but yes, I can't. Sasha will always be associated with that.
Well, I think I've lost that interview, but there we go. So, how is writing a speech like writing a novel?
I treat everything I write in the same way, I think. I think my novel writing, because I wrote speeches before I wrote fiction, and so my novel writing comes from the way I work on speeches, which is where I think I'm very, I write quite tightly, I write quite quickly. I don't start writing anything until I've got a very detailed point-by-point plan. I think of everything in terms of how many things a reader can take away with them. They all have a very clear beginning and a middle and an end. Also because I studied rhetoric, so I understand the way sets of words work on our brain and how they release certain chemicals and create different moods. And I'm absolutely obsessed with this now, in the way that rhythm works, repetition works. And so I use them both in my novel writing and in my speech writing, and that's become more and more so actually in my novels. I've become more obsessed with the language as much as the story, I suppose. And in the same way, my speeches are, whenever I've written a speech, I've thought of it as a story, and that there's a story I want to tell, and it has to be as engaging as engaging whatever audience it is, as if I was telling Cinderella to a group of 7-year-olds. It needs to be that level of exciting for them. Otherwise, they can put their headphones in and listen to something else, frankly, or yawn and wonder when they're going to get to go to the finger buffet.
I've never heard of word order dictating chemical release before.
Oh, it's absolutely fascinating how it works. How metaphor works on our brain by creating pictures. It's the only way our brain can understand abstract concepts like joy and love is through metaphor. But rhythm is fascinating, and repetition. Because if you think about the way repetition works, they all feed into either ethos, logos, or pathos, which I'm sure you know from speech writing. But when the brain looks for order, so even in logic, the brain isn't looking for truth, it's looking for the semblance of truth, something okay. that looks like truth. So repetition, if you say it enough times, it sounds like it must be true. And the same goes for rhythm. If words sound like they go together, we assume that they're true. It's why it's so used so much in advertising. A Mars a day helps you work, rest and play. That works on our brain in a reason. It tells our brain that it's somehow true, and it's satisfying. And little tiny shots of dopamine get released when we hit that rhyme sound. And it's all these conduce to make us either buy things or, in my case, writing speeches, I wanted to move them literally to the polls. Obviously, you want them to vote for you. And I didn't know this at the time, how it worked in neuroscientific ways. It's only much more recently that this is being discovered. But the more I learn about it, the more I realise how I can use it in storytelling as well. And then if you think about it, the way rhyme works in picture books for young children, and the need to wait for that lovely rhyme to come at the end of a line, and it's the huge satisfaction. You can see it, how it affects a child. It does the same to us as adults, but we don't notice it. We don't realise what it's doing to us. And then we go out and buy a Mars bar without thinking about it.
That's fascinating. Never come across that before. And yeah, you've spoken about politics, of course, political speech writing, big part of your life as well as journalism. Do you remember the speech or the politician that made you go, oh, I want to look into this?
Yes, absolutely. It was Bill Clinton, and it was his first election campaign, and I was studying, it was called Contemporary Cultural Processes as a master's degree at Goldsmiths at the time, and I was doing a module in political communications. And we were shown a video called The Man from Hope. And it was Clinton's campaigning video, and it was made to look like amateur videotape. I mean, some of it was pieced together, but it was so incredibly clever. They created this vision of a man who was one of us, one of the people. And by the end of it, I was crying watching it in class. I do cry a lot at films, but at big, you know, story films. And I was watching this thinking, but this is a story. They've created this incredibly clever story with a beautiful narrative character arc for Bill Clinton. And I thought, I want to do that. I want to not make films. I've never been a visual person in that sense, but I wanted to write something that would make someone cry and then make them go and vote. And that was so my aim has mainly been with whatever I'm writing is to make people cry, which is slightly disturbing.
It's a mild sadistic streak.
Yes. But it was that I thought it was an incredibly clever spin. Spin in a good sense. Spin, I think what people forget about spin is that spin, it comes from cricket balls, I think, doesn't it? It doesn't, the way you put a spin on the ball so that it slightly goes into a different direction. It's still true, though. It's still the cricket ball. So when we say spin, we're just making it look the best it can be, making it do the best it can. But it's still, at its essence, the truth of someone. So that's what I wanted to do what I did was to try to make everything look as good as it possibly could be. And I rewrote the most turgid policy documents into things that would be understandable and potentially even exciting. And I suppose that's what my speciality was in politics.
Taking incredibly dry material and making it powerful.
Making it powerful. And, yeah, and finding ways to make it powerful for different audiences as well. But you're still always working with the same raw material and the same facts. Mm-hmm. They don't change, but the way you tell the story has to change. In the same way that if I'm telling Cinderella for 8-year-olds, it will be told in one way. But if I'm telling it for adults, you start doing an Angela Carter on it and you make it far more dark.
Mm. Spin does seem to have a very negative connotation to it. I don't know whether that's purely based on the thick of it or whether it's more history of it. You worked alongside Alistair Campbell for several years. What did you, apart from what you said about making it as good as it can be, what did you learn from the days in Downing Street?
I learned I learned everything I know about political campaigning. I hadn't been a hugely political person until I saw the bill. I'd always voted and I'd always been quite vocally left-wing, but I'd not thought about policy or anything behind it. And I was plunged in at the deep end when I got the job. I'd come from radio. I was a radio presenter when I then went into politics, having had no political background, no knowledge of any policy. I was there purely because I could write. So I learnt huge swathes of policy very quickly. I learnt political history very quickly. I learned how you run a good political campaign, how you fail at political campaigning as well, and how you can only work with the raw material you've got. And sometimes that raw material is not good enough because the policy or the politician is not good enough. And yeah, I feel very sad that the years I spent are hugely tainted by the concept of spin and by Iraq, obviously, because there was so much good done as well. But the concept of spin being bad, and the idea, even I think now, to the extent that we think rhetoric is bad, that we think it's too clever by half and a lie when it isn't a lie at all. Rhetoric used to be taught alongside maths in schools. Up until relatively recently, it was one of the most important things, way more important than science. Science wasn't taught in public schools. And it's dropped by the wayside as science grew, to the fact that we now see it only as something that either posh school people do or liars, when actually we all use rhetoric all the time. We speak in metaphor. I think Will Storr says we use a metaphor every 10 seconds in speech, to the point where most of them are cliches because we don't recognise them as metaphor anymore. But it's a skill we all have and we all use, and we should all be able to recognise it when it is used, because sometimes it is used against us and very cleverly. And so I suppose I learnt the beginnings of that there, but having come out of it, it's only now that I've looked into the far more at the background and the science behind rhetoric, because it is a science, you know, when you start to look at it in that sense.
Mm. And like you say, he's perhaps a slightly problematic figure now, or a controversial figure, even at the time then. But Tony Blair was undoubtedly a hugely charismatic, brilliant storyteller, politician, and very successful at that too. Is it because of this narrative idea that you think he was able to achieve such success in the polls?
He was very good at, I mean, he writes all his own speeches now, and did mostly then, or worked with Alistair. He knows how words work, and he knows how to tell a story. He knows, which makes it sound, not tell a story in the sense of a lie, but he knows how to capture an audience and be engaging in that sense. He had that kind of charisma in the same way that Clinton had, and which I do not see in any current politician, sadly. He had that concept of, he embodied ethos in a way that none of them do now.
Moving on to novel writing, you mentioned in the past that you came up with the character of Birdie Jones by quite a patchwork quilt method. I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that and how you managed to come up with such a character.
Character for me is everything. I find it absurd when people say, oh, my book is very plot-driven. It's not a character book at all. Because character is plot. Your plot is only what it is because that character has made decisions and gone down the only path they can possibly go down. So for me, character is the beginning and end of everything. And I cannot start to write until I have spent a long time with characters in my head, talking to them and working out how they would behave in any given situation. And I usually write, for years I wrote in first person, and so I could hear their voice speaking to me. Birdie Jones was very different. When I pitched the book to my editor, the character that became Birdie was a boy, and I had a very clear picture of who this boy was in my head. And it was an actor called Will Poulter, who was in a film called The Son of Rambo.
Mm-hmm.
Shaved head, fascinating looking boy who looked like he would definitely play the Artful Dodger in a remake.
I can see that.
Yeah. And then, but my editor said, no, it needs to be a girl. And I reluctantly eventually agreed. But I couldn't hear her and see her at all. I couldn't get this girl in my head, however hard I tried. Until I saw, my daughter was watching Stranger Things, and there is an actress called Millie Bobby Brown, and she'd shaved her head. And I was looking at her thinking, that's my girl. That's the female version of Will Poulter right there. But I still couldn't hear her voice. I messed around with it, and I eventually thought, I'm going to try something crazy. I'm going to try writing in third person, which I just didn't do at that point. And so writing with a narrator who talked about her as, in the terms of her, she. But again, my narratorial voice as a woman was not working. And I can't remember exactly how it came about, but at some point I realised that the narrator needed to be a man and much older, and he needed to have a northern accent. And I actually Googled actors born in Yorkshire in a certain year, and Sean Bean came up. So now Birdie Jones is Millie Bobby Brown as narrated by Sean Bean. In my head, that's how I hear it when I hear her voice on the page.
Wow, presumably that's the only role he hasn't died in.
Yes, Birdie does not die, I will.
Spoiler alert.
Yes.
There's a franchise to make. How would you define a relationship between an editor and a writer then? And why was your editor so determined that Birdie had to be a girl?
I'm not sure why. I'd written a lot of boys, I think, by that point. I'm not sure of the reasoning behind it, because we often say that girls will buy books in which both boys and girls take the lead. Boys will only buy books in which boys are the lead. I don't know if that is still holds true, or if it ever held that true, whether it's just a rumour. I don't know if that was something behind it, but then in that case, why decide on a girl? I honestly don't know why. I mean, she's the same editor who said you need to write about a dog, which I resisted and resisted because I do not like dogs very much, except for greyhounds. And then we compromised on a greyhound and I wrote The Incredible Billy Wilde, which I now love, and I now adore greyhounds and want to adopt one. But editors in general, she was and is a brilliant editor. And the best way I can describe it is like an editor is like your brain on its best day. They can see what it is that you're trying to do and help you do it. Because sometimes you've been stuck in the story for so long you can't see the wood for the trees. And they know what it is, where you're trying to go, and what the best bit about your story is when you can't see it yourself, and they will help you get there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's going to be on posters around.
I'm sure. I'm hugely grateful for editors, and it's my main, I suppose, one of the main reasons why I can't imagine why I would ever self-publish, because you need an editor. Everyone needs editing. And if you think you don't, you are so very, very wrong.
Well, talking about casting roles, your book, Joe All Alone, has recently been... was turned into a CBBC show, which then was nominated for a BAFTA, which then won the BAFTA, and is just a couple of weeks ago nominated for an Emmy. So, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
Have you already cleared space for the Emmy next to the BAFTA?
I've never even seen the BAFTA.
Are you going to say Joe All Alone?
No.
That would be a bad move.
It was... No, I actually...
I've not read the book.
No, amazing. That was one of the most amazing moments of my life, actually, was meeting... I got to go to the first cast read-through, and to see someone that you've made up in your head suddenly in front of you walking and talking was just beyond anything I'd ever imagined. It was absolutely incredible. Far more incredible to me than winning BAFTA. It was such a sublime moment for a writer. Yeah, I didn't even get to go to the BAFTAs. I should have done, but I had a fall, as we older people say. I didn't fall. I had a fall. Couldn't walk. I couldn't go to London for the BAFTAs. I'm delighted we won, but I have never seen the thing. And
do you not get a little? Do you not get a statuette?
They should send us a mini one.
Yes,
all of us.
At least a chocolate one.
No, I suspect it sits in the production office, frankly,
under armed guards.
Yes,
and much spotlight. Did the character, the actor, fit the role in your head? Was it sort of, this is who I've been picturing for the past 4 or 5 years?
He wasn't at all who I'd been picturing. I think I'd probably been picturing Will Poulter in that role as well for some reason. There's this incredible...
You're obsessed.
No, but he's this sort of weird vulnerability about him, I think. And he always looks slightly upset and angry. No, Daniel Frogson ended up playing Joe, and he was nothing like I imagined, but absolutely perfect for the part. He was brilliant, and they all were. They were all nothing really as I'd imagined in my head, because a lot of them were based on real people that I'd known, and who'd not grown up with. My daughter had grown up with them around when we lived in Peckham, so they were real. So they were so very far from the people I'd written, and yet they were absolutely brilliant in the roles, all of them. I can't, especially Joe Sim, who played Dean, was terrifying in a way that I hadn't envisaged at all. So yeah, it was, I'm so happy with what they did with it. And
wow.
And Daniel is now in the Northern Lights on the BBC, which is an absolute joy to see him go from that, because I think it was his only his second ever acting role. He was taken from the, I think it's the Nottingham Film Workshop, the one that Shane Meadows used for This Is England, where he found Thomas Turgoose. And so it's absolutely brilliant to see Daniel going on to do great things.
Are you going to make it to the Emmys and try not to fall a couple weeks prior?
Do you think I'll be invited? I'm guessing no.
Why not?
Script writers are the lowest of the low in the film world, but the original writers of the novel, we're below them. So I doubt very much.
Why are writers so low down in the pecking order?
I have no idea, because they are... Without them, the story doesn't exist.
The blueprint.
No. Having said that, I totally see why it is... I mean, the director changes everything. It's their... It is their story. I'm not precious over my work. The script written by Guy Burt is incredible, and it's not what I would have written, because I did ask to write the TV script and they ummed and ahed and eventually said no. And then I saw what Guy had done and thought, yeah, because I wouldn't have come at it from that visual televisual angle. I would have come at it through words, through dialogue, and that was the right decision. And then, again, then Beryl Richards, who directed it, had her part in it as well, and she had a certain vision for it. It's a shared thing, and then whoever watches it will put their spin on it. We all partake, we all become authors of a work. So I'm not precious about it, but at the same time I still think that writers deserve a little more credit than we get.
Yeah. Do you think it's a hangover from the silent movie days, when it was just sort of a page of he falls onto the train tracks, he's rescued at the end? And it's just never been corrected from that. That's the only logic I can see as to why. Because directors are exalted, actors, of course, are exalted.
Because you see them on the screen.
Yeah.
I don't know. I honestly, that's an interesting concept. I've never thought of it like that.
Bit, because they get to go on stage. No one wants to hear what they say, but they get to go on stage and have the spotlight. And yet writers
still wondering what producers actually do. Having had a producer credit on television, thinking, but I wrote some stuff, but I wasn't producing, but everyone seems to be desperate for producer credit. It is disappointing. I don't know where it comes from. I want to investigate why it is.
Well, that's a little holiday task.
Yes.
Should you not have enough on at the moment? Well, I hope you win for the selfish reason.
Thank
then you'll
you.
Be the fourth Emmy winner we've had.
I hope I win, just for that reason.
Please. It would mean a lot to me, and I know that's the primary aim. You've recently started working with other writers to collaborate on books, which seems a divergence from your previous writing career, previously writing solo, but yeah. With Sir Chris Hoy. Others now. How do you find writing in a partnership as opposed to writing by yourself?
I thought I'd hate it. I thought I would struggle with it because I'm very organised. And I'm also a bit of a control freak, and I want sole charge of it while I'm doing it. I'm totally happy to be edited, because I've been edited for years working in politics. When you've had the Prime Minister's red pen on your work, you lose your sense of ego and you just do as you're asked. But working with someone else felt a massive step. But actually, it was it's incredibly freeing, because I'm so organised, because I plan for months before I start writing, so I know what will happen in every single chapter before I start writing. And then Everybody Hurts, which I wrote with Anthony McGowan, we wrote it chapter by chapter in a game of ping pong, as it were, that went on for 3 years. It was supposed to take a matter of months. He knows he's to blame for that. but it was both frustrating and incredibly exciting, because I would write a chapter and I'd send it to him, and then he would write the chapter. And you wouldn't know what was coming back. You could have been thrown a giant curveball, because we started out writing the story knowing it would begin in a hospital canteen and it would end in a disused sewer pipe in Leeds. That was all we knew. Like all good love stories. And it was a love story. And he was writing the part of the boy and I was writing the part of the girl. And every time he'd send the chapter back, I'd then furiously plot an entire book so that the chapter I wrote, I knew it fitted into a story somewhere. And then I'd send it off and he'd send me another complete curveball. And it was hugely fun to write like that. With Chris, it was different because we sat before each... we didn't do it individual, but we did it via series, because we wrote five and then we wrote another five. And so before we wrote the first five, we spent a huge amount of time sort of throwing ideas around and brainstorming and working it all out. And then I would write the plan and send it to him and he'd fiddle with it and send it back. So it was still planned out. But it was, again, it was just incredibly exciting. He has a massive imagination, more so than mine. And there were things that he wanted to do that I would never have dreamt of doing. Because I'm far more, well, that's just not possible in this world. That wouldn't work. He's going, no, let's do it. Let's try. Because he has that sort of spirit in him of very much, I'm going to go for gold. And he does. He's
literally.
Whereas I'm like, no, I like parameters and borders. And I think we worked quite well together in that sense. But again, it was both those instances have been two of my best writing experiences, actually. And I would love to do it again. I'd love to collaborate again on something like that. It's very freeing for me. And I find it, I write more quickly and concisely and, yeah, taking all offers, frankly.
What is a writing experience that you've yet to have but are really interested in?
I think possibly screenwriting. I've done a little bit. I used to write, bizarrely used to write for some puppet Worms that presented Nickelodeon many years ago. Early Worms, they were called. They did the breakfast show on Nick. And I wrote scripts for them. And I've written TV scripts and radio scripts, but for non-fiction, for magazine programmes and things like that. But I would like to write fiction, I think, for screen, purely because it's a challenge, actually. It's something I haven't done before, and I'm very much, well, if someone tells me I can't do it, as which they told me with Joe, I'm very much, well, I will show you then, which is how I ended up working in politics, actually. It was mainly to annoy a man who told me I couldn't do it.
Like all good origin stories.
I think at some point I'd like to try screenwriting. I did think it was writing prose poetry, and then I started doing it and thought, no, you're just, this is not for you. Don't go down that road. Let the people like Sarah Cross and Lucy Cuthew, who are good at this, let them shine in that area and stick to a full, I don't know what you'd call other prose, normal prose, full-out prose. I can't think of any other. Poetry in general terrifies me. Just screenwriting for now. That'll do.
With your producer credit, that'll help boost that.
Oh, no, I don't even know what... That was probably on an election programme or on something called Planet Nosh, a children's cookery show.
I mean, those are wildly different ends of the spectrum.
Oh, I've never worked with children and
politicians.
And politicians and food, and I did all of them, yeah.
Wow. What writers throughout your life, be it first discovering your love of books to now, have really inspired you? What are the top three that you could, if you could invite to a dinner party, who would they be?
I don't think I'd necessarily invite them to a dinner party. Some of them, well, for a start, one of them would be Roald Dahl, whose books completely captured my imagination as a child, and who, when I came back to writing for children when I was in my 30s, I went back and I reread everything, and those were the ones I wanted to almost recreate. So Roald Dahl would be one of them. Joan Aiken would be another, and actually I would love to have her to dinner. She wrote a beautiful series called Arable's Raven, very, very funny, illustrated by Quentin Blake, about a small girl called Arable, whose father is a taxi driver, and who runs over a raven on his late night taxi run, brings it home to be revived, and Arable adopts him. He's called Mortimer, and he's a terrible pest. And that series completely captured my imagination as a child. It was read on Jackanory. And again, that was the style I tried to imitate, I suppose, when I was first starting to write. The third one, who I would definitely invite to dinner, is Frank Cottrell Boyce, who is an incredible writer, not just for children, for adults as well. He also wrote the Olympic opening ceremony, of all bizarre jobs. But his way of writing child voices is, I can only imagine he has a similar thing. He must hear them, because when I'm reading them, I hear them. And they are such distinct voices and such brilliant stories. They're very, very clever. Cosmic, Millions, the Astounding Broccoli Boy. They're just incredibly funny and incredibly moving at the same time. And the message is, there is always a message behind them. It's very, and not in a didactic moral of the story kind of way, because kids don't buy that at all. But just, you are going on a journey with that character, and at the end you are changed, and you know why and what it is Frank has been trying to tell you. So I'm a huge admirer of Frank, and he continues to influence my writing for children now.
Well, my final question is, very simply and very broadly, why are stories important? Why do we need stories?
Stories are the only way we make sense of the world, all of us, not just storytellers. They are how our brain functions. We cannot understand anything around us unless it's in the form of a story. Ourselves are a story we tell ourselves about ourselves. It's how we retell that story. We fiddle with it. We edit ourselves constantly. And it's this, we have our origin story in our head all the time about why we are, how we are. Without gesturing wildly, I can't explain how important story is. Read The Science of Storytelling by Will Storr, who is far better at explaining it. It is the only way we can understand and, more importantly, change the world is through story, which is why it is my life.
It's no big deal then.
No.
Jo, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.